I'm Chris Malcolic, and I've met Bridget about 2 years ago. She's graciously and patiently been my sponsor for about, 4, 5, 6 months. She's teaching me how to live sober, which I have no idea how to do. So let's say she has a lot of patience. She lives and breathes the program, and I think she's awesome. And so here she is to tell her story.
Can you see me behind this podium?
You need a booster.
Yeah, I need a stool. My old home group, they used to tell me to stand up all the time. Even when I was standing up, they told me to stand up or get up out of that hole. I'm Bridget. I'm an alcoholic. For those of you who were expecting to see John tonight, you can go. I mean, you don't have to listen to me. No. I was kind of put, there was a switcheroo pulled on at the last minute, so I am real honored to be here. This is my home group, and I just haven't been participating in it as much as I should, so I guess this was a sign that I needed to be back over here. I'm going to tell you, I'm nervous. Everybody says they're nervous, and they don't like talking about themselves, but don't let them fool you. We're alcoholics. We like to talk about our favorite subjects, which is ourselves. So, and, you know, I know a lot about myself, so you're going to hear some of it. sorry. I'm going to tell you what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now, and about my journey. And I was born. How's everybody start with? No, I wanted to start with a story. This past weekend, my little sister turned 50, which, you know, made me feel a little old. But I had an opportunity to fly up to Michigan to celebrate her birthday with her. And I knew this is my family, right? And I knew there was going to be a lot of drinking, and I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle that. But, you know, it says in the big book that depending on our spirit, if we're in fit spiritual condition, we can go anywhere as long as we have a good reason to be there, right? So I'm like, I feel like I'm in pretty good shape. And I wanted to be there with my sister. She's my favorite sister. I have three of them. I love them all dearly, but I have a favorite. And she's it. She's the only one in my family I didn't owe any amends to. It's really weird. But anyway. So I go up there. And my brother-in-law is running around like a crazy man, trying to get ready for this party. And he says, well, I got the beer. I got the cooler. I got lots of ice to put the beer on the ice, and we're going to put it in this thing out here outside the garage. And he's, you know, just naming off all these things he's going to do and getting the bar set up in the garage. And I said, Pat, what are we going to eat? Oh, well, I'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. You know, I'll go get some chicken or, you know, chips. I'm like, man, planning a party. But I knew it was going to be like that. So I tried to be as helpful as I could, and he gave me some money, and I went to the store, and, you know, I helped get that party ready, you know, and that's not me, because I like to sit back and watch other people do the work, and I just want to have a good time. And so I helped with that, and then the party started, and it was just like I expected it to be. Everybody was drinking. Nobody got out of control, which was really interesting, because I thought that was going to happen, because they were doing the drinking and they were doing those left-handed cigarettes too back around behind the bathhouse there. But all that to say, you know, and I walked around and I picked up stuff and, you know, kept the place neat and just kind of wandered around and talked to people, and I actually had a really good time, and I didn't ever once want to take a drink. Some of those people, when they were drunk, they're kind of silly. but I didn't get uncomfortable at all. So something, I'm not saying I did it. I'm saying the program was working me. And that's what happens when when I start doing what those things that are suggested, when I do them, I can be okay going places where I never was before. You know, I would be the first one with the drinks at a party, you know, and the last one to help clean up because I was either passed out or just didn't want to do it. Let somebody else do it. Lazy. Anyway, so back to my little story. I grew up the oldest of five children, and my dad was alcoholic. My mom was insane, untreated Al-Anon. I always wish she would drink. You know people like that? You're like, just all you need is a drink and you'd be all right. It was the oldest of five, and my mom had five kids in 7 years, so I'm 7 year old and I'm changing diapers. So I had to grow up really fast. And you know, and I always said I had to grow up very fast. They made me grow up. No, nobody made me. That was what I did, because that gave me worth. You know, and that's how I was seen. I'm taking care. You know, I'm taking care of these kids. And I maintained that role for. Sometimes I still slip back into it. You know, the caretaker, the big sister, wants to. Make everything okay. And I'm an untreated Al-Anon too, in case you hadn't noticed. But my I was a quiet kid, and I was always you know, I hear people talk about, I went to Catholic schools in elementary school, and I hear horror stories all the time about people at Catholic schools getting their hands popped with a ruler and getting spankings and whippings and all that. And I didn't have any of that. I had a good experience in the Catholic school, but I was a little girl. I'm still a little girl. I was always a good girl, you know, and I loved school. And I know today now the reason that I loved school was because I never felt safe at home. And when I was at school, I was safe. And those nuns loved me. And so I was good and never got in trouble. I always had good grades. It was at home when I would get in trouble. And I would get in trouble because somebody else did something and I should have kept them from doing that. When I had my first drink, I was 14, and my dad fixed it for me. He fixed me a rum and coke. And till the end of my drinking, I was still drinking rum and cokes. I don't know what it is about the first drink you have, but for me, it just stuck. And I liked that because my dad would sit around with his buddies from work, and they would, you know, talk about important things. They talk about stuff going on in the news. They talk about politics. And it was always intellectually stimulating to me. It was like he was always teaching me something. And I thought I was so cool to sit there with my dad and his buddies and drink with them and talk with them like I was a grown-up. And even my dad went to school when I was in junior high, and he would come home and share with me what he learned in his psychology classes, you know, and I thrived on that. You know, that was the attention I got. And my mother didn't like that because he didn't talk to her like he talked to me. And I think that a lot of the reasons that she treated me that way were because of that. So started doing that, and then, you know, I played the piano in high school, and in junior high is when I did some of the craziest stuff. I remember smoking my first left-handed cigarette on a school playground when I was about 12, something like that, and I would go hang out with my friend Doreen at her house because her brother was a dope dealer and we always had pot. And that was cool. That was really cool. And when I was 13, my mom found some pot in my jacket that wasn't mine. It really wasn't mine. And I think about that today as a parent, and I was 13 years old, and how I would react to that with my 13-year-old, you know. But so when I got to high school, I tried to straighten up because I wanted to play piano and I wanted to be a concert pianist. That was my dream. And I went to college the first year and studied music. And my piano teacher told me if I wanted to be a concert pianist that I needed to practice more. And I said, well, how much do I got to practice? I practice an hour a day. She said, no, baby. You want to be up on that stage? You need to practice 8 hours a day. I said, oh, no, 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 no. She said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, but I got to take English and math, and I got to take all these other college courses, too. She said, yeah, I know that. And I said, well, when am I going to party? When am I going to, you know, have a good time and hang out with my friends? She said, well, you know, you want to be a concert pianist? You do this. If you don't, you do that. And so I chose to do that. I didn't have the self-discipline to practice 8 hours a day. And I did a half-assed job for a year. I did practice. And I had some talent, so I could get by with the minimal. But eventually it caught up with me. My drinking became more important because I was working at this bar and I was wanting to work the night shift because the tips were better because everybody would be drunk and they, you know, slip you a 10 and didn't even know. but then I liked it even better after closing time. So I dropped out of college and I started dating a fella that my parents didn't like. And so they sent me, they weren't really good about sending me off places. You know, they just couldn't handle me, so they'd send me off. So they sent me to my grandparents up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I don't know if you know anything about that, but there's nothing up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan except snow and bars. And so they thought that they sent me up there, they could get me away from this fella that they didn't like. Well, he came to visit me up there. They weren't very smart. but there's nothing to do in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan except to drink, right? Okay, that's where I really learned how to drink. It was every night. And my grandfather would sit in the dark when I come home and he'd say, you're never going to find a nice boy at the bar. I'm not looking for a nice one. but I ended up getting a job with this construction company, and that's where I met my first husband. And he was 10 years older than me, and I really liked him because I could see when I turned 18, the drinking age in Michigan was 18. So I was off, you know, I'm legal now. Well, when I was 19, almost 20, they changed the drinking age to 21. I'm like, well, they can't take that away from me. Oh, yes, they can. But I liked Kenny because he was old enough and he could buy my drinks. And, you know, back then they weren't real strict about, I would sit at a table, he'd walk up to the bar, get my drink, and bring it back to the table. I mean, they weren't really paying attention to that. But that's why I liked him, because I could drink all I want. And he would take care of me. So we got married, and I moved to Texas. And then he worked this, he was an industrial fire brick guy. So we would work at these cement plants. Any place they had the brick kilns where they fire things. anyway. And so he traveled all over, and so I traveled with him, and that was the best time because I didn't have to work, and we'd go stay at these hotels with swimming pools. And he was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and so I had it made. I could sit at that pool all day long and drink margaritas and, you know, hang out with the other ladies at the pool, and it was great. It was great for 5 years. All I did was follow him around and partying. We moved to Memphis in 1980-something-something, and I finally got to a point where I wanted to settle. I wanted to settle and stop doing all this running around. And I wanted to go back to school, so I went back to school. And my husband was still traveling, and I said I wanted to stay and go to school. So he would go out of town for, I don't know, 3-4 weeks at a time and then come back. And this was before cell phones, computers, any of that stuff. And so he would go out of town, and sometimes I wouldn't hear from him for 2 weeks, and I wouldn't know where he was, how long he would be gone. And I learned at that age not to be afraid to be by myself. And I was early 20s, and drank a lot when he was not there. But anyway, school, and I started meeting people at this school, and I got a job, a part-time job at this school. I hadn't had a job in 5 years, you know, and that was like empowering. I had this part-time job as a secretary in the dean's office, and he would let me do my homework at night because I worked at the night shift in the dean's office, and he would let me do my homework at work. So I had it made. I was going to school during the day, studying at my job at night, get off of work at 10 o'clock, and then go party all night long. It was awesome. And I had friends. I had a life there. And he didn't like that one bit. So when he came back from one of his things, and he said, "We're going to move to California now." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not moving." And, you know, there's a whole big ugly story about that. But anyway, he ended up going to California, and I stayed in Memphis. I took care of myself. For the first time in my life, I took care of myself. And he told me, and I don't know, nobody else is like this. If somebody tells you you can't do something, you know, he told me he will never make it without me. And I just said, "Watch me. Watch me." And that gave me all I needed to just do what he said I couldn't do, which included the drinking. I really don't know how I got through college. I don't know how I ended up getting a full-time job. I did well in my job. I don't know how I did all that doing what I was doing. And you hear that all the time. People talk about their drinking and what they actually accomplished while they were drinking. You wonder, but I also wonder what more I could have done if I wasn't. I ended up getting married a second time to my son's father, and I went from being single and having a ball to married and three kids within a year. And I was drinking a lot, and I was gonna try to be the savior of this poor family, this man whose wife was a drug addict and left him with these little girls, and I was gonna take care of them. And I didn't take care of them any better than their mother did, and she left. But he got a little, he used to drink a lot. And it was really easy for me to look at him and say, "Man, I don't drink. Why can't you drink like me? You know, why do you have to drink?" You know, and I had to hide my booze from him because he would drink it all. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I used to go to parties and take my own because I knew they wouldn't have my brand. And then I would not put it on the bar. I would keep it by my purse over in the corner so nobody would drink it. I didn't think there was anything strange about that. But things got ugly. He agreed to go to AA. So he agreed to go to AA. And I said, being the supportive wife that I am, I will go to Al-Anon to support him. So I went to Al-Anon, and I had this great Al-Anon sponsor, and she took us through the 12 steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was hardcore Al-Anon. And she told me that part of what she wanted me to do while I was working through the steps is to go to one open AA meeting a week. So I had this regular Saturday night meeting that I would go to as open AA and sit there and listen to all these poor people telling their stories. And I just kept doing that. And then I was working steps with this sponsor, and she, we were talking about honesty. And she said, one of the things, here's the things you're supposed to do when we're working the steps in Al-Anon. Here's the things you need to do. You need to not drink or drug of any kind while we're going through the steps. Now, once you're through the steps, you know, but while we're going through the steps, you don't need to drink. I go, why? I'm not an alcoholic. Why do I not get to drink? And she goes, that's just one of my rules. You know, you go to 3 Al-Anon meetings a week, and you go to an open AA meeting a week. Well, she ain't going to know if I drink anyway, so I was drinking. And I lied to her about it. You know, I'm like, and after, I don't know, I was in Al-Anon 9 months when I had that moment of clarity. And I was talking to her, and I realized that I was drinking and lying to her about my drinking. And if I didn't have a drinking problem, why did I find it necessary to lie to her about my drinking? And I had this friend, Susie, and I would go out with her, and I'd say, Susie, do you think I'm an alcoholic? She'd say, Bridget, I don't know if you're an alcoholic. I said, well, you know, I do this and I do that, and this is what I think. And she goes, well, you know, you grew up in an alcoholic family, and maybe it's just the isms that you're experiencing. But I would always ask her, Susie, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And one time she just said, Bridget. She said, I don't know if you're an alcoholic. She said, but think about this. People who are not alcoholic do not sit around and wonder if they're an alcoholic. So, I went to my first AA meeting as an alcoholic shortly after that. And that was when I was in Memphis, and that was when they gave out, and they still do that, the plastic poker chips, white chip. Picked up my white chip. And after that meeting, you know, I picked it up at this open meeting that I used to go to all the time. And people were coming up to me after the meeting, you know, and congratulating me and hugging me, and I'm blubbering, and they're saying, man, I'm glad you finally came over the fence. You've been on the fence for a long time. I'm like, how do you know that? And they said, we've been watching you. You're laughing at the wrong things in these meetings. So they teased me for a long time that I came in through the back door. I came in through the back door of Al-Anon. And I'm grateful for Al-Anon to this day for that, and the Al-Anon sponsor I had. So I embraced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober. I got involved in service work. I had sponsees. I loved AA. And I raised, my son was 6 years old when I got sober. And I was always proud to say that he never remembered seeing me drinking. So I stayed sober for I was going through all the motions and all the steps, and I did that for 12 years. And I went to Cancun with my sister. And I had enough frequent flyer miles that I could get first class flight to Cancun. And what happens with first class? Free drinks. Well, I get on that plane and I'm thinking, I know they get free drinks, but I'm an alcoholic and I don't drink. And so I didn't drink. Great flight. Get to Cancun and, you know, they have these hospitality parties at the pool and free drinks. And I'm like, okay, Matt, go drink. I'm not going to drink. Didn't occur to me to drink. I was alcoholic. I was sober 12 years. I mean, it just didn't occur to me to have a drink. And I think it was the fourth or fifth night we were there. We went to this really fancy seafood restaurant, and we had to wait in the bar for our table. And she sat down at the bar, and I was standing behind her, and she said, I think I'll have a Chardonnay. And I said, I'll have one too. And I started drinking that night. It was just like that. And to this day, I'm like, I don't know what happened. It was a switch. It was one minute I'm like, there's no way I'm going to touch a drink. And the next minute I'm saying, sure, I'll have a glass of Chardonnay. And I didn't get drunk that night. My sister did. And I took care of her. And I didn't... When I got back to Memphis right away, I called my sponsor and I told her. Then I had to call three of my sponsees and tell them. I had one of them say, can you still sponsor me? I don't care if you're drinking. Like, yeah, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and some are sicker than others. But no. And that was really hard to do. It was hard enough to tell my sponsor, but to tell those sponsees who loved me and, you know, counted on me to be there for them and to share my experience, strength, and hope. I felt like I let them down big time. And the miracle of this program is that all the 6 years that I stayed out there drinking, they never turned their back on me. They were always there. They would call and check on me, or I would call them, and they'd say, how are you doing? And I'd say, I'm okay. Still drinking. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. Well, at least you know where to go if you get in trouble. Like, yeah, I know where to go. So I came back and I picked up another white chip shortly after that. Let me see. Picked up another white chip in March of 07. And then I picked up another white chip on April the 8th of 07. And then I didn't pick up my third one until December of 2012. So that 6 years was crazy. And, you know, when they talk about in this program that it never gets better and it almost always gets worse. And I found that to be true, very true in my case. And I also heard it's easier to stay sober than to get sober. That's why there's five dates scratched out in the front of my book. You know, the first time I picked up that chip, the first chip, I picked it up and stayed. And coming back, that was hard. I think it was easier for me because I didn't have to face those people in Memphis because I'd moved here. So I could come in here and y'all didn't know me. But it was hard, you know, to come back. But I'm real grateful I did. Where was I gonna go? You know, talking about how bad it got for me. I always had a good job. In fact, when I was in Michigan in 2007, 2009, I went to Grand Rapids. I got a job in Grand Rapids. And I was selling some stuff on Craigslist, and some people had come to pick up some stuff from my apartment. And the guy said to me, he said, what are you doing here in Grand Rapids? What do you come here for? And I said, I got a job. And he said, you need to be on the news. You know, back in 2008, nobody had jobs, especially in Michigan. But I always got, you know, I was always lucky to have decent work. And but I find myself driving to work every day thinking, I'm just existing. I'm going to this job, and I'm making money, and I go to the bar, or I don't even go to the bar. I go to the liquor store, and then I go back to the apartment because I didn't know anybody there. So that's all I did. I did, at one point, take salsa dancing lessons, which got me out of the house. But, you know, that's surrounded by drinking, too. So I traveled around a little bit doing consulting. So I was in Michigan, a couple places, and I ended up in Ohio. And I really thought I was going to go back to Michigan. That's where I was from. But I couldn't take those winters. I went through 3 winters up there, and it just about killed me. I said I wanted to move south, but I didn't want to go back to Memphis. I didn't really like Memphis. But I like Nashville. So it's just like, okay, I'll just move to Nashville. People think I'm crazy. You know, why did you just move? You didn't know anybody in Nashville. I said, I was not afraid. You know, something, I don't know why. I was just, I was too stupid to be afraid. You know, I have a sponsee. I was talking to her last night, and she lives alone, and she's always worried about noises around her house, and she's got cameras outside of her house, and she said the dog was barking and freaking her out. I'm like, you know, I've just never been scared. I guess I'm just too stupid to be scared. I don't know. But I do those kinds of things. I just do them. Toward the end of my drinking, I was had this great job, and I was traveling, and, you know, you get to stay in these nice hotels, and they always have nice, pretty bars. And, you know, it's the first thing you see when you walk in. You see these pretty bars, and I was having the time of my life, and work hard all day, and then go to the bar at night until I just pass out, go back up to the room and pass out. And I'm not going to go into that one, but needless to say, I mean, y'all are drunk, so you know, I took some risks. I participated in some risky behavior that I never, ever would have done sober. And I was talking to one of my previous AA sponsors about it, Christmas of 2012. And I told her everything, finally. I told her everything. And she suggested that when I got back here that I would go to a meeting. And so I did. And I went to Seeking Sanity, the Wednesday night meeting there. And I sit there in the meeting, and, you know, I'm just like on the edge of crying. You know how we do. that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, that's where I was. And so I went to that meeting, and I didn't get a chip that night. And went home, and I had a liquor cabinet full of stuff. And I said, well, what am I going to do? Well, I got drunk. I got drunk that night. Seemed like a good idea. If I'm going to get sober, I might as well get drunk one more good time, you know. And I did. And that night, I fell in the bathroom. And I didn't hit my head. And I'm grateful for that because I have this really hard tile in my bathroom. And I fell in my bathroom. And I made a mark on the wall where I hit the wall. Just kind of made a little indentation in the wall. And the next morning when I got up and I saw that, I thought, man, I need to go to another meeting. So I went to Seeking Sanity, the women's meeting on Thursday night. And there was this lady there that I'd never seen in my life. That after the meeting, I did pick up a chip that night. I was telling them about the booze in my cabinet at home, that I had a lot of booze left. And I didn't want to go home. And that lady, who I'd never met in my life, came to my house with me and emptied out my liquor cabinet, poured it all down the sink, because I couldn't do it. And I'm grateful to her for doing that for me. So I stayed around for a little while and then see what was my next date. Oh, I drank, it must have been New Year's Eve I drank, because it was January 11th when I picked up the next one. I don't know. But anyway, so when I picked that one up in January, I'm doing this thing. I was pissed. I didn't want to be here. I was angry. I was so mad. And I was at that meeting in Mount Juliet, Easy Does It meeting, and Nancy. I liked her. She was from Michigan. So I attached in Upper Peninsula, Michigan, too, so I attached myself to her. And I was telling her, Nancy, I'm just so pissed. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I've been trying, you know, I've been doing okay, but I just drink too much, and I just really don't want to be an alcoholic. I'm pissed. She said, well, maybe you're not done. I'm like, yeah, I'm done. I'm done. I've done all this stuff, and I'm done. And she goes, well, maybe you ought to start working on those steps. I said, okay. So I stayed sober for 90 days. I got a 90-day chip. And this smart-ass guy said to me, he says, you know what comes next? After 90 days, I said, what? And he said, 91 days. He's a smart-ass. So I went out of town, and I was working at this job in Miami, and I love Miami. Right, and I'm in Miami, and it's not in the summer when it's really, really hot. It was like March and April. March, April was beautiful in Miami. And I had this real stressful client down there. And we went out to dinner after a real stressful week. We went out to dinner one night, and they were talking about getting drinks. And on the way over there to that restaurant, I thought, I'm drinking wine. I deserve it. I'm celebrating. I can just drink a glass of wine. And, you know, that's when they tell you you're supposed to call somebody, right? And I'm thinking, I'm supposed to call somebody. I ain't calling somebody because then they'll try to talk me out of it. And I'm not going to get talked out of it. I want to drink. I want to drink. And so we got to the restaurant, and I ordered my wine. And I drank my wine, and then I got a second glass of wine. But I didn't get the third. Then I came back. I came back in town and felt like crap. I felt terrible because I just felt terrible. I don't even know how to describe it. You know, just defeat. You know, defeat. Got me again. And so the last one I picked up was this last time was April the 18th of 2013. So I just celebrated 2 years. And I didn't think I'd make it 6 months. That second 3 months was really hard. Really hard. But I got over the being angry thing. And I remembered from before what a great way of life this was and how things will only get better. And it changed me how I fell inside. You know, it's not about how long I drank or how much I drank. You know, I had old men telling me they spilled more on their tie than I ever drank. It's not about that. You know, I remember this old man in when I first got sober. He was in this room and he was always talking about he lived under a bridge when he got here and he had one combat boot and one tennis shoe when he got in the program. That's all he had. And then he would talk about what he felt like, what he felt in here. And I could relate to that. And that's when I realized, you know, I am one of y'all, and it's about what it does to us. It's about what that drink does to us, for us and to us. And I didn't like that man for a long time because I didn't want to admit I was like him. He was from under a bridge. He had one tennis shoe and one combat boot. How could I possibly relate to him? Today I love that man. I haven't seen him in a while. And I'm going back to Memphis this weekend for a little bit. I might go to a meeting just to see him. Today I'm working with my sponsor, and she's taking me through the steps again. And I'm stubborn. I mean, I want to do it. I want to get the goodies, right? I want to get the goodies, but I don't always want to do all the work. And but I do it. I don't do it right away. I have a tendency to put things off, you know, a little procrastination. You know, I have a sponsee that reminds me of that. You know, that I get a lot from my sponsees. And you know what I hate the worst is when they parrot something back to me that I said to them. That's the worst. or when I give them advice that I need to hear. You know, they want to say, are you listening to what you're saying? But I do what she recommends that I do. I do what she suggests I do. And I have this sponsor, you know, I have a sponsor who calls me. She doesn't wait for me to call her. If she hasn't heard from me in a couple days, she calls me. And I'm grateful for that because, as we all know, it's hard to pick the phone up. And I stay on the phone a lot in my job. I'm on conference calls all day long. The last thing I want to do when I get off work is pick up the phone and call somebody. So I appreciate when she calls me and just reminds me. And eventually I do what she tells me. That's why I'm going to Memphis this weekend. I'm in the amends phase of my steps. So I'm going to Memphis to make amends, to my final amends actually, one to my sister and one to my son. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to those, the 9-step promises. You know, and some have already come true, and they can come true before you get to the 9th step. Just do what we do. Insanity, I just want to say this one thing about insanity. I heard this really, this was really good. When I struggle, you know, when I think about, I still, from time to time, I still have that, do I really, am I really that bad? You know, am I really that bad? You know, I didn't lose a job. I still have my house. I'd never got a DUI. All those things and all those stories that I hear in these rooms, none of that happened to me yet. That's what where the name of this group came from, probably, right? Yet. You're eligible, too. I didn't get a DUI because I didn't get caught driving drunk. It's not because I didn't drive drunk. Insanity, this lady said, think about the 3 most important things in your life. You know, and what are those things? And she said for her it was her job and her animals and her, what else was it? I don't remember what it was now. And then she said, this guy said, okay, those are the three most important things in your life. And he said, and those are the 3 things that you will risk by taking drink. You don't, how did she say that? That's insanity. The 3 most important things in your life you're willing to risk for that drink. And that helped me just to think about how insane I was because, and still to this day, because I can do some stupid stuff. But that's what makes life worth living and gives me good stories to tell. Some good experience, strength, and hope. Today I just try to do it one day at a time and try to realize that I'm not in charge and that something way bigger than me is in charge. And I try to... have fun. I'm always laughing and cutting up about something. People who know me know I'm not serious very much of the time, even in my job. Anyway, I'm done talking about me, but there's one part of this big book I want to read. My home group in Memphis was Waggle, and it's W-A-A-G-L. And it's from page 132 of the big book. And we used to read this every meeting. Page 132. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. And at this point, everybody says, Waggle! So, Yay, okay. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. That's my story. Waggle. Yay.
Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,